You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Thursday, the 22nd of December. It's Shemina here, your host, and my producer Pearl is here too.
Hey.
Hey Pearl.
Hey.
What's up?
Throwback Thursday Wire.
Yeah, hashtag Throwback Thursday.
Woo!
Yeah, so it's our final Thursday show of the year today, where we'll be doing a wrap-up of the year that was and playing a few highlights of our favourite shit that played this year. So to start with, we've got an interview I did earlier this year with economist Shamabil Yaqub about the quite frankly very crappy housing market we have in New Zealand. And we'll also be playing a report I did about RNZ selling their Auckland office space.
We'll also be talking to Labour leader Andrew Little for the final time this year about the year in New Zealand politics and also Labour's priorities going into next year. And after that, we've got part of an interview I did with the founder of the Global Drug Survey.
We'll be talking to Jason Leopold, our US correspondent, for the final State of the States this year. Today, we'll be looking back at the dismal year that was in the US in US news.
And to finish up, we'll be playing some of our more pop culture-centred pieces we did this year. My interview I did about how the Harambe meme is racist, and also Shemina's report she did about the origin of the word yas.
If you want to let us know some of your thoughts about some of the stuff that we're covering today, please give us a text on 5395 or give us a call 093879. Let's get into it.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Earlier this year, I spoke to the very awesome and articulate economist, Shamabil Yaqub, about the housing problems New Zealand is experiencing at the moment. Even though a lot of media attention gets paid to Auckland's housing crisis, the issue of unaffordable housing is actually more widespread throughout the country. I started by asking him to tell me about the housing bubble Auckland is currently experiencing.
Well, house prices have been rising very rapidly in Auckland for some time, and it has become so unaffordable now that over half of adults in Auckland are now renting, with very little hope that they will ever get into the housing market anytime soon.
In your book, you talk about how housing issues in New Zealand are not just limited to Auckland, though. So other areas of the country are affected too. Can you tell me more about this?
Yeah, so there's also been a wider increase in house prices. So pretty much from the early 1990s, home ownership in New Zealand has been falling. And that's been really because of changes in the economy, changes in house prices relative to incomes, and it's been pretty widespread. The reason why homeownership matters is kind of quite a few different things. The first one is probably a very social and personal thing, where homeownership is a very important part of being a Kiwi. It really identifies us as being part of community and society, and that social pressure is actually very important. But also there are some other very practical things, like having that security, being able to integrate with your community, all those bits that go with having a home, not just a house. And in retirement and in savings, housing is also very important, because that's been the traditional way that New Zealanders save money, both for their, you know, kind of one-off expenses, but also for their retirement. And if you don't have your own home, when you get into superannuation, it's really not enough money. And everything in New Zealand is kind of set up with the assumption that more and more people will be accessing homeownership. Except, of course, homeownership rates have been falling for about 30 years.
And so what are some of the factors that have made housing in New Zealand so unaffordable?
Well, you know, the really big one is that we're simply not building enough houses that are fit for purpose. And as a result, what it's doing is increasing the cost of housing relative to incomes, and more people are being priced out. For example, in the last 5 or 7 years, what we have seen is there's been quite a big increase in housing supply, but most of it has been in 4 and 5 bedroom houses, whereas most of the demand is in 1 and 2 bedroom houses. And so we're building lots of expensive new stock, but we're not building the kinds of affordable and entry stock that people really need. And this mismatch is really because our rules and regulations around land use, our rules and regulations around planning have been quite stuck in the past, and we're simply not being reactive enough, proactive enough when it comes to meeting the needs of New Zealanders.
So you describe owning a home as being a cultural expectation in New Zealand, but do you think Kiwis should just try shift their attitudes and not see renting as a second-rate option?
Well, owning is such an important part of our culture that it's very difficult to shift. But we also know that many adults, and the majority of adults now, are renting. And so it's not so much that I think we need to change our sights. I think we should still aim for home ownership because there are many positives to it. But in the meantime, while we are renting, and majority of Auckland's adults are renting, we should try and make renting much better. And when we talk about renting being better, we're really talking about trying to mimic some of the benefits you get from owning your own home, having that security of tenure, being able to make minor alterations, being able to have a pet. These are the kinds of things that are really important, but also what kind of reasons you can be given for being kicked out or what reasons you have to give notice. Right now, it's really in a very precarious state. It's not really good for landlords. It's not really good for tenants. And it's a really bizarre situation where we kind of have these tenancy rules that are geared up for essentially what you would have in a student flatting situation, but not for people actually having lives, actually having families, actually trying to have a home in a community. And we know that there are examples internationally in places like Germany and Switzerland where majority of people rent, but they have lots more rights that go with rentals, lots more responsibilities. And that means that what it does is that even if you're renting, the house becomes a home and it gives you some kind of stake in community, some kind of stability, so you can raise a family and have a normal life.
So what are some of the negative consequences of rising house prices?
Well, I mean, for the few that own homes, it's wonderful because they're getting richer. But for the rest of New Zealand, what it means is that it's really locking people out of two really important things. The first one is around that wealth accumulation, being able to access that traditional ladder of savings through the house, and which is also linked to entrepreneurship. So most small businesses in New Zealand tend to be started with money borrowed against the house. And if we have fewer and fewer New Zealanders, and young New Zealanders in particular, who are not able to buy a home, they will not be able to start a business in the future. So we're limiting ourselves both from the financial security perspective for individuals, but also for the economy in terms of the lifeblood of economic activity, which is small businesses and new businesses. The other thing is around the social aspect. You know, we're starting to create this two classes of New Zealanders, the landed gentry and the rest. And it's very unhelpful to have a society that is so divided across these two groups and where we have these growing inequalities of wealth that just accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. Because what it tends to do then is it creates all these tensions, jealousy, distrust, mistrust, and it means that the social fabric, which is built on trust and understanding and empathy, begins to fray and begins to fall away. And if we're not standing together as a nation, then it's very difficult for us to do things that are right. And the more inequality we have, which is linked to the housing situation, I believe is going to lead to a situation where New Zealand becomes a less empathetic place where we don't really look after each other.
Right, because I guess there was a lot of talk in the media last year about how baby boomers are fueling the housing crisis as they are buying too many investment properties in New Zealand. So do you think this critique is perhaps focused in the wrong direction?
Not really. I mean, we know that one of the big reasons why people buy houses is not just to live in, but also to invest in. And because of just the massive bulge of baby boomers coming through, just at the time when mortgages became much more freely available and cheaper, and we have tax rules that are just so advantageous to put your money into property investment, that's exactly what boomers did. And the baby boomers have benefited very much from the rising house prices, but you know, what they're also doing is essentially creating these massive rifts for the next generation. We really need to get to the bottom of how we deal with speculation and this incredible bias towards residential property investment, because what it's doing is we're putting so much of our effort into buying houses from each other and we're borrowing so much money to do it. We're starving the rest of the economy in terms of new businesses which are going to create long-term economic growth. There's a few solutions to it. I mean, the easiest ones around tax policy. We really need to get much harder on residential property as a proper investment, and that should be ring-fenced, no negative gearing, all those bits and pieces. And we need to have a comprehensive capital gains tax on all rental properties. And we need to start thinking about regulating our banks much better so they don't keep plowing so much money into the property market every year and more every year.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was an interview I did with economist Jamabil Yaqub about the housing crisis. Next, we have a report I did a couple of months ago about some concerning developments over at our fellow broadcaster, Radio New Zealand. It's come out recently that Radio New Zealand intends to sell their Auckland studio and office space. In a staff email that went out, RNZ announced they were looking for possible buyers to take over ownership of the building so that they can then rent the space back off them. But what might some of the long-term impacts of this sale be? Does it pose risk to the future of New Zealand's only public broadcaster? I spoke to a few people over the course of the last week in order to try find this out. Standing outside RNZ's Auckland space, it's easy to see why it's an appealing prospect on the property market. Located on the bustling intersection between Hobson Street and Cook Street in Auckland CBD, the value of this building shouldn't be sniffed at, considering the city's overheated property climate. When it was last assessed by Auckland Council on the 1st of July 2014, the capital value of the property was $9.7 million. But that was more than 2 years ago, so it's estimated that it'll sell for a lot more than that now. The reason for the sale is cited as being due to how the responsibilities of building ownership detract from their primary focus as a public broadcaster. This is a quote from the email they sent out to staff.
Building ownership is not a necessary element of this strategy, and the obligations that come with owning and managing properties divert time and money away from more important initiatives. Growing our presence and capacity in Auckland does remain a key component of our audience growth strategy, and hopefully over time this decision will contribute to us advancing these ambitions.
But some have been a bit more critical of the move. Claire Curran, Labour's broadcasting spokesperson, says RNZ has had no choice but to make the sale.
Our only non-commercial public broadcaster is being forced to sell a major asset in order to keep afloat. And it doesn't seem like a sustainable financial strategy, but they've been put in this position after 8 years of a funding freeze by the central government.
In 2008, the newly elected national government imposed a freeze on the station's budget, meaning that they've received a static amount of $35 million each year for the past 8 years. Although that sounds like a lot, rising costs mean it doesn't buy as much now as it did back then. So things are getting harder for RNZ as each year passes. In the last year, they've cut around 20 staff members from their team. Jim Clark, a spokesperson for the Coalition for Better Broadcasting, is also concerned about the implications of the sale.
You know, eventually they may have a short-term gain from realising the property sale, but long-term, that'll eat away pretty quickly. We reckon in about 13 years conservatively, as they have to eventually, they need to start paying rent for the two floors they occupy, and then they will have to lose the rental income they're receiving from the other three floors, including ground floor rental. So long term, it's a bad move, but you know, just trying to get some short term gain. Suppose they're hoping that maybe in the next intervening years they will get a funding increase so that, you know, they'll be able to bridge the gap.
RNZ unfortunately declined our invitation for an interview. But when CEO Paul Thompson addressed some of this criticism in a recent interview with Stop Press, he said people's concerns about the sale shouldn't be given too much weight and that the comments show a naivety on how these things work. He added that he isn't concerned about the possible risk of rental price increases and that from a landlord's perspective, RNZ is a very good, stable, long-term tenant. Nevertheless, making a shift from a property owner to a renter in a city like Auckland is a pretty major handover of power. Even though RNZ is intending to seek a good landlord who they can set up a long-term tenancy agreement with, who knows what might happen in the future if the new owners decide to sell to a potentially less benevolent buyer. This is Shemina Smith reporting for BFM News.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Well, shaken, of course. Never stared.
All right, no problem. Oh, my God, that's f***ing James Bond.
What? What the heck is he doing in Kohimarama?
I don't know, something to do with Lee Tamahori. He wants a martini.
Is that a beer?
I guess I just get something from one of the goons. Ugh, why did we even open a bar?
Well, we inherited all these stools. What the hell else were we supposed to do?
If your drinky poo skills are drinky poos, tune in to Cocktail Corner. Every week on Thursday Drive, a fancy guest mixologist gives a crash course on the art of adult beverage creation. Proudly brought to you by Red Bar and Chi.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
A couple of weeks ago... Sorry. Nope. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke to the impressive Adam Winstock, an addiction specialist, psychologist, and founder of the Global Drug Survey. And this expert...
Sorry, everybody. Pearl's just having a wee moment.
Sorry. Just very rushed.
She also has her headphones on in a very hilarious way as well, which is just...
Wasn't ready, but yeah. I'm back.
She's back. She's going to read the intro.
It's the end of the year. It's the end of the year. Just
get
like this.
Yeah.
In this excerpt, we speak specifically about drug reform, but if you want to listen to the whole 16-minute interview, then where we touch on the purpose of the Global Drug Survey and specific drug trends of 2016, please head to 95bfm.com. Every year, do you sort of like, are there specific objectives in each survey that you put out in terms of what you want to know? Are you adapting the survey every year?
Yeah, so there's like a core bit of the survey that looks at prices and purchases, kind of who ends up in A&E and things. And then every year we look at kind of bits and pieces that are really, kind of like just particularly interesting that year. So this year, the four things that we're focusing on in the specialist section. So when you get through the first 20 minutes or so, you get kind of given a selection of other things. And this year we're looking at cannabis legalization. So we're asking cannabis users around the world, how would you actually want to see cannabis regulated in your country? And that's really important because no one asks real experts. So that's one. Two, we're going to look at cannabis as medicine in the real world. So if you're using it, what condition, what do you use, how often do you use, how effective is it, do you have any side effects? The third thing is drug vaping. So everyone seems to think that the only drugs you can vape is kind of nicotine and cannabis. That's not the case. And so we're looking at other drugs that people are using. And then the fourth thing is we've got a lovely little section on psychedelics. So we're looking at the whole issue of people microdosing with LSD and magic mushrooms to improve creativity and work performance. We're looking at people's use of ayahuasca. And finally, we're trying to understand what people mean when they say they have a bad trip. Because psychedelics get a bad name because of this idea of a bad trip. And the truth is there is a big difference between someone having a difficult experience when taking a psychedelic and having a bad trip. And part of the reason people are exploring psychedelics as treatments for difficult emotional conditions like depression or PTSD is that it can allow people to process difficult emotions in a way that ultimately can allow for transformation and growth. So we're working with some psychedelic expert groups to try and understand what people mean when they talk about difficult or bad. So yeah, that will be really interesting stuff.
Definitely. And I think, I mean, I guess this is so broad, but what would you like to see be done either, you know, domestically in the UK, in New Zealand or globally to sort of reduce drug harm? What do you think are sort of the key things that need to happen?
I think it's just kind of honesty is the best policy. You know, and so the first thing I would want to see, and this is on the back of a big nightclub in London called Fabric having been closed down because of MDMA-related deaths and recently being allowed to reopen, but with really punitive kind of rules, you know, effectively going zero tolerance for drugs. And actually what I'd like to see is legislation from the police and licensing that would be applicable to nightclubs, pubs, people who run festivals. And the legislation would be, if you are going to run a large event where there are people here drinking and likely to take drugs, it is mandatory for you to have information on your website about how to use drugs more safely. And you will have your staff not just trained in responsible service of alcohol, you will have your staff trained in how to recognize and respond to risk related to drugs. And that should be put down in law. So instead of the current situation where if a promoter or a bar owner phones up local police and says, you know what, I think I might have a bit of a problem with coke in my club, they'll lose their license. They get shut down.
Yeah.
What you have is a different situation. And the reason that's so important is there's lots of good places to get really good information about drugs. Global Drug Survey, Aeroid, Blue Light, Tripsit, whatever. But lots of people don't bother.
Mm.
And if you had all of that information there on all the big kind of club websites, promoter websites, venue websites, people would go, I'm waiting for 2 minutes for my ticket to download or whatever. I'm going to go and get a little bit of information. That's kind of what I'd like to see. And I think I'd just like to see governments being a little bit more honest. I understand changing drug laws is difficult. It's politically a bit risky. You know, there can be some backlash. But at least governments could go, look, even though drugs are illegal at the moment, and we're looking at how things might change. We want to protect people. And so what we're now happy to do is start having an honest dialogue with you. So we, you know, the reason we don't want young people doing drugs is because the brain's developing and they're more vulnerable to harm. You know, the reason we don't want people smoking weed every day is that, you know, 10% of people get dependent and, you know, it can kind of reduce the potential in your life and make you emotionally distant. But if you smoke weed every now and then on a Friday, hey, you're probably not that much of a problem. If you've got a mental illness, it's a bit of a difference. It's just being honest with people. The idea that you can ban drugs and that's the only way of reducing drug-related harm is just, it's just not true. It's outdated. It doesn't work. So just start treating your population like adults.
Yeah.
You know, people who use drugs want to have fun. They don't want to ruin their lives or anyone else's.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was Pearl's interview with the founder of the Global Drug Survey. Now I have on the phone with me Labor leader Andrew Little. Kia ora, Andrew. How are you doing? So we thought our last week with you was last week, but you're calling us from your holiday this week and you've just done the Otago Rail Trail. How was it?
That's right. Oh, fantastic. Yeah, we did. I did it with my 15-year-old son. We took 5 days to do it. It was easier than we expected. We thought we could have actually done it in a shorter time, but we had a fantastic time on it. And yeah, really recommend it to anybody. It's suitable for all ages.
Awesome. Cool. So the year on New Zealand politics, what do you think were some of the major issues in politics this year?
Oh, I think clearly housing affordability and homelessness are two aspects of the housing equation that I think have been huge issues for New Zealand, and they've gone completely unanswered really by this government. I think and just the growing sense of inequality, which is expressed not just in the housing thing too, but just a whole chunk of people whose wages aren't keeping pace with the cost of living, which explains homelessness as, you know, as well as other kind of consequences of poverty as well. So, yeah, I just think there's a growing sense that in spite of a government that talks about a growing economy and rising wages, there's a whole heap of people who are not feeling it and are not sharing in it, and are now much more conscious that maybe this kind of trickle-down stuff, you know, make sure we give tax cuts to the wealthy, that doesn't work anymore and we have to look for something different.
Right, so you think that those are the major missed opportunities that the government did this year?
Yeah, I'd say there's a lot of term stuff too. I mean, we don't seem to be that good at debating publicly kind of the long-term stuff. We have a political cycle that seems very much focused on the short-term. I mean, it's why we as a party, we spent the last 2 years doing our Future of Work Commission, which is looking at 20, 30, 40 years, at, you know, the impact of technology, what's happening with work practices, how people earn a living. But the government's not doing any work on any of that stuff, and that's coming at us at a fast rate of knots. Certainly next year I'm going to be spending a lot of time talking about what that future looks like, what we need to be doing now, you know, and having an education system, for example, that's fit for purpose, and, you know, where young people aren't having to go into a huge amount of debt to get qualifications to do jobs that are changing so rapidly. So it's things like that I think are going to be, ought to be at the heart of a lot of the debate we have about the future and future wealth creation for the country.
So, but even if the current government is favouring this kind of, I suppose a short-term approach, they've still been polling pretty well all throughout this year, and much higher than Labor is polling. Are you hoping that's going to change a bit next year?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you campaign for election, you've got to build your support, build your numbers, and I think that's absolutely clear. I think I've had 2 years since I've become leader, which is dealing with some of the internal issues, just getting the party organisation sorted, getting the caucus functioning, focused, working well together, trusting each other. That's all sort of come together. We've done the work on the big kind of policy stuff that we want to be talking about next year. And the areas that are our strength and that are also important to New Zealand, which is why we've talked about housing. It's why we're making an issue about education. You know, we see those two international tests recently that show us actually getting worse in terms of our educational performance. And things like health, you know, what's happening in the health sector, elderly people not being able to get the treatment they need. So all those sorts of things we've made a focus on. We've put some good ideas together, and next year's task is now to take that out to the country, talk about that stuff and talk about the long-term stuff as well. I'll be doing that pretty much from the beginning of the year. I have my State of the Nation speech on the 29th of January, and then followed by about a 2-month-long kind of just getting around towns and cities talking about what we stand for and what we want to do for New Zealand.
And so do you feel like the Labor and Greens partnership is going to strengthen the left in next year's election, or are you worried that there are perhaps some compromises Labor will have to make?
I mean, the nature of NMP is that no party, neither of the big parties, gets to govern on their own. You do have to have support partners or coalition partners. And I think the electorate, in this day and age, New Zealanders with NMP 20 years old, expect political parties to give a clear signal about who they would partner up with. We've done that with the Greens. Now, naturally, for both Greens and Labor, we've got to be able to present a package to New Zealand that says we can provide and form strong, stable government, and with a set of ideas that answers today's problems, and also provides some long-term thinking about the direction that we as a country need to go in if we're going to maintain our standards of living and preserve the planet and make sure that this is a fantastic country for people to live in and come to in 20, 30, 40, 50 years' time.
And so also, do you think the resignation of John Key and the recently appointed Prime Minister, Bill English, will significantly change the political landscape going into 2017?
It'll certainly change the dynamic. There's no question. I mean, John Key seemed to be popular, very well regarded as very popular, although I think a couple of things told me that things were going in the other direction, the Mount Roscoe by-election, the local government elections. But I think he certainly had a very strong personality that a lot of the media, a lot of people seem to respond well to. I mean, one of the frustrations I certainly had in the couple of months leading up to that is that we just, no matter what we said, we couldn't be heard. We could say outrageous things, and people who did say outrageous things also got coverage, but if you wanted to have a genuine debate about genuine issues, we found it hard to kind of get heard. And yet, it didn't matter what John King said, he was often reported uncritically and just accepted regardless. So I think that will change, and so it does open it up. But I don't underestimate the task ahead of me at Labor to win the confidence of enough New Zealanders to say, we can put together something that is viable, that will work, and is good for the long-term interests of all New Zealanders.
Right, so you think perhaps the departure of Teflon John, as he's often referred to, might have some positive impacts for Labor?
I don't want to overstate it because I don't, again, I don't want to underestimate the task ahead of me, and I don't take anything for granted. I've got, and Labor's got, we've got work to do. But at the very least, it will change the dynamic about how public debate gets run, about, what reporters actually start to report. And I'm almost certain it will give us opportunities to be heard that, frankly, we've struggled to get in the last few months.
Absolutely. Well, that's all we've got time for today. But thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us, Andrew.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you and to all your listeners.
Absolutely. You have a great, great one too, and we'll chat to you again in the new year.
Look forward to it. Thank
all right,
you,
bye.
The Cold Cut Solid Steel Show, the worldwide oral institution that's one of the longest-running mix shows on the dial, arriving fresh each week with a bounty of the broadest beats currently banging the globe. Playlists posted regularly on 95bfm.com for your referencing pleasure. Solid Steel Show, 2 hours of melted down, mashed up musical madness. 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. every Saturday night on 95BFM. Solid.
Thank you.
State of the States with US correspondent Jason Leopold.
Hey, Jason, how you doing?
Hey, how are you? Great to be with you today.
Yeah, yeah. So for our last show of the year, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, wow. Okay, great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So just the last show before we head off for a Christmas and New Year break. So I guess I just wanted to catch up with you about some of the big things that happened in the US this year. I guess it's been a pretty turbulent year in the US, to say the least.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that 2016 has been a shitty year. It's been a pretty horrible year on many different fronts, certainly in politics. I mean, look, you know, there's breaking news out right now, if you want to call it breaking news. I'm not sure I would agree with it being breaking news, but the final results are in, and more Americans voted for Hillary Clinton than any other losing presidential candidate in U.S. history.
Wow.
She has nearly 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. And so that sort of underscores the fact that, yes, Trump is the president-elect, but he does not have a mandate. He didn't win the popular vote. It really raises questions about this archaic electoral college system we have in place. And it also, I mean, that really is what dominated much of the year. You know, the fact that you had this contentious political campaign between these candidates, and it's already off to a pretty odd, strange start in terms of who Trump is appointing. I mean, it's you look back on 2016, and then you just wonder, you know, well, geez, what does 2017 have in store? The fact that you have this president-elect choosing billionaires, really, you know, one could argue that, you know, these oligarchs that he's choosing for these high-level cabinet positions. So I think one of the other, if I may add, the noteworthy things just moving over to the Obama administration. He's going to be leaving office not being able to fulfill a promise to close Guantanamo that's going to stay open. I was actually just there. They're also over there trying to figure out, well, geez, what's going to happen under a President Trump? President Obama is trying to move out about 17 to 18 detainees within the next month. And that would whittle down the number to about 42. But it really looks like, you know, Donald Trump is going to keep it open. And whether or not he fills it up, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even both these things, though, they kind of almost point to problems that exist in the system, right? That, you know, like Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, and yet Donald Trump's going into the White House, and then also Obama,
right,
that he couldn't do all the things that he was kind of like wanting to do because, you know, there were so many barriers to him trying to make those things happen, right? So, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you captured it perfectly, and I think that, you know, you're right, it is the system. It's certainly, you know, a system in place where, you know, say people in my state, California, you know, their vote, doesn't really, it feels like it doesn't count, or in other states where, you know, you feel like your vote doesn't count, whereas a vote in a very small state has, you know, far more, far more power, if you will, than other states. So that's part of, you know, that's part of the system. The fact is Obama swept into the White House 8 years ago, promising, hoping to change politics in Washington. It's actually gotten worse, and I think President Obama would be the first to, you know, to say that. It certainly does not look like it's going to get any better. That we're going to see, you know, things improve. I mean, the country is still divided. You know, it's still, there's still quite a bit of partisanship in place.
Absolutely. And so going into 2017, how are things looking politics-wise?
Well, that's really what, you know, what the big question is that we're all wondering, because it's hard to predict, you know. Trump is a wild card. Donald Trump is not a your typical, by any means, obviously, you know, president-elect. We don't know what he's going to do. You know, the big talk by from Congress, obviously, has been repealing Obamacare. You know, the health care legislation, you know, government health care that was put into place that accounts for about 20 million people who have health care coverage. And, you know, Republicans have said that, you know, one of their first acts when the new Congress is seated is repealing that. It actually may end up being far more expensive to do so. So, you know, it remains to be seen exactly what they're going to do. I mean, and that would actually hurt people. So, so you have that. I mean, with regard to, I think, you know, what we're all looking at is, foreign policy issues. You know, what's going to happen, in, you know, conflicts that we're involved in, wars that we're involved in, you know, around the world. And that's really up in the air. I mean, it's very difficult to predict what, you know, what Trump's agenda will be. I think what's really going to be all-consuming, however, is these Senate confirmations that are going to need to take place for Trump's nominees. So, for example, his a nominee to head the State Department, to be Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, the chief executive of ExxonMobil, who's, you know, has ties to Russia, you know, questionable business practices that we've seen in documents. I mean, you know, there's a possibility that some of these nominations can be derailed, or they just won't get confirmed. So it's going to be really, really contentious. I mean, I think that even the inauguration on January 20th, I kind of think it'll be pretty ugly. And if you want to look back to 2009, when you had over a million people show up in Washington to, you know, support and welcome President Obama, because that was a milestone. I mean, we excuse me, you know, voted in the first African-American president. And here we are 8 years later. I mean, that where we are 8 years later certainly shows, you know, that's a great example of what some of those problems are, you know, that exist, that partisanship,
President Obama wasn't able to bridge this, you know, divide between Republicans and Democrats. The country is still, you know, sharply divided. And, you know, so it's, you know, we're all here, at least in the media, kind of like trying to figure it out. But it's one of those instances where you can't even predict it. And if I just may also add, in terms of reporting it, because you have a president-elect who takes to Twitter and lies, outright lies, he makes things up. His officials that he's appointed, you know, to as part of his transition team, make things up. It's very difficult to then try and obtain information from, you know, people who are anonymous sources and report it, because it may not be, one, it's the likelihood, who knows, you know, it may not be true. And the public obviously will have, will question it, will question the veracity of that information. So, you know, the reporting game, reporting on this administration is going to be a huge, huge challenge.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, it looks like it's going to be a very interesting year going into next year. But this is that's all we've got time for today, unfortunately, Jason. Thank you so much for speaking with us every week this year. It's been such a pleasure. Will we?
Thank you. Yeah, mutual.
Yeah, absolutely.
Happy holidays to you and everyone, and thanks to your listeners as well.
Absolutely. You too. We'll be back with you next year.
look forward to it. Take care.
All right, you too.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Harambe has arguably been the biggest meme of 2016. In May of this year, a gorilla named Harambe was shot in a zoo in Cincinnati after a child managed to make its way into the gorilla's enclosure. After a quiet break in the media headlines, the event exploded into a huge global meme. Earlier this year, I spoke to Kazai Rex, a reporter based in Baltimore, about Harambe and wider racial cultural meme trends. I started off by asking him what his main issue with an article posted in The Atlantic called How Harambe became the perfect meme.
I just found, a friend of mine posted it, and someone in the comments just mentioned, like, doesn't reference race once. I thought, you know, there's no way. Like, The Atlantic's a big publication, you know, great writers, of course. And, you know, I'm coming through, and it's kind of like one of those, like, you know, shrugging your shoulders, quirky, like, how about that thing? And I started on the piece I wrote for Good that night, like after I read it, because I don't know, it jumps out at me, you know, being black, kind of having, like I said in the piece, that trope of apishness or whatever else, I don't know, that was like an automatic thing for me. So I was kind of like taken aback by the fact that The Atlantic kind of chalked it up to memetic weirdness and the internet being the internet.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's also like a trend I've seen with, you know, comments on the Harambe meme that I've read or listened to in podcasts. You know, everyone just seems to think it's like this sort of like lighthearted, funny, oh, he's just a gorilla. And it's like, and I just think it's interesting that it's like taking this long to seen it, you know, be talked about earlier. You know, I listened to a Reply All podcast without talking about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't mentioned once.
It's like a confluence of a bunch of things. Like, yeah, everybody's talking about it. Yes, it's super versatile, as I'm sure you've seen. Like, there's literally hundreds of different variations of this thing. And it's got that, like, dark underbelly of racism that kind of, like, stokes the fire.
Yeah, definitely. What were sort of, like, your biggest issues that you see with the meme?
Well, it's funny that you asked me to speak today, because just yesterday or the day before, sometime this week, I can't remember. What's kind of like, I don't know, been stuck in my craw, I guess, is when it kind of crosses over from that like funny haha to topical stuff. Like, it'll use like events surrounding police brutality and, you know, police murders of black people in this country as like a reference point. Like, the one I saw yesterday was Miami Dolphins and NFL team here. Four or five of the players, I think, kneeled during the anthem, which is like a big deal here now, which really shouldn't be. You know, they have the right to do that. And I think their message is on point. But somebody photoshopped like Harambe or a gorilla kneeling next to them. And I see that, and, you know, all sorts of, you know, alarms go off. And, you know, I'm used to this kind of thing. That doesn't mean it's right, but it's just like, stuff like that. And early on over the summer, this is coming from like hardcore trolls, so I don't think this is average people doing this. But it could be, for all I know. But you know, using Mike Brown and people like that, Trayvon Martin, to kind of like splice in to your Harambe joke, it's like totally unnecessary, you know, and crosses a line. But like, I think you know, I had a few people close to me, acquaintances, like ask me what the issue was, and it's kind of like when you see that kind of thing, that's like mocking, but also not like forthright with the mocking. It's troubling and it hurts, to be quite frank. When it's like piled on, because the stuff with the internet, it's like it's not just one and done. Like, you're gonna get like a stream of it, or copycats, or retweets, or reposts, or whatever it is. So I think that's kind of like what's been striking for me, is just like you said, like, it's been, the staying power's there, the ubiquity's there, and it's just like so forceful that I guess in a way it is perfect. It's perfectly racist, and it's got like the platform to kind of proliferate the way it has.
Interesting how it also, like, I think relates to like the whole media coverage of the event in the first place. You know, it was almost like people were getting more upset with the death of a gorilla than they were with, you know, deaths of black people in the States. And I think Do you think the memes relate to that? You know, because it feels like that happened, it died down, and then the Harambe meme sort of popped up.
I was honestly, before I started, like right as I started writing this, scratching my head, because there was a point over the summer, like late summer, where a number of people I follow, not just white people, black and white people, were like making songs, like tribute songs to Harambe, like on their iOS notes or whatever. And there was some funny stuff in there, but I was like, you know, didn't this happen 3 months ago? I'm completely lost as to where this came from, like the second wave of this came from. And I remember when it did happen in May, if I'm honest, the initial reaction was, you know, some, you know, stereotypical Desperate Housewives type, let her kid do whatever the hell he wanted, and he ended up in the gorilla pen. So when it was revealed, you know, by the media that this is a black child, I think the tone kind of switched for everybody, not just the people who are still, like, putting these memes out there, where it was kind of like, okay, that happened, the kid's, you know, not hurt or dead, that's good. And then, you know, like I wrote about, there was kind of like a refractory period where it kind of died down, and then, like, this backlash that was highly racialized, you know, start kicking back towards the family, and all of a sudden I know that the father has a criminal record, which is like a total non sequitur, has nothing to do with anything. But as we've seen with, you know, black people who were murdered by the police here and elsewhere, you know, the big media feels it necessary to let me know that, you know, so-and-so had a drug conviction 13 years ago. Which somehow legitimizes the fact that they're dead at the hands of police now. So yeah, I think it's I don't understand. I mean, it's just like everything with the internet. I think it's like, you know, the ebb and the flow, and this just kind of has flowed more than ebbed, I guess.
Definitely. And also, like, there was that kind of idea around how, you know, Harambe was such a successful meme because, you know, it's an African name, you know, it's Swahili, and it means togetherness. And do you think, would you agree that it's a way for sort of, you know, white people and stuff to sort of make fun and laugh at this without feeling racist?
Yeah, I mean, I think, at least from my conversations with random people on the internet, you know, my followers and close friends as well, there is that impulse to, you know, to go there, so to speak, right? Like, I think last year the thing was, why can't white people say nigga or the N-word, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, all sorts of black people in media, celebrities, regular Joes are explaining why that's not cool and why that's not going to work for you guys. And it was still kind of like, well, why not? You know, still that insistence. So I think this was kind of, again, like a perfect storm of, we have this, let's go with it. And I had, like, an old friend comment on the piece when I posted it on my private Facebook page about, like, the Harambe movement in Kenya is, like, a self-help movement. And his explanation for this whole thing was that it related to that. And I'm like, I'm not an expert on all things, especially not all things African, but I have never heard of this before. I'm sure most Americans have not heard of it, most people on the internet. So I think it's kind of a bogus thing. But yeah, I mean, it's like, I was thinking earlier, like, the whole conversation with cultural appropriation is coming back up because of the Marc Jacobs Fashion Week. And it's kind of like, you have, you know, the different camps, and one of the camps is saying, like, why is this a big deal? Why are we still talking about this? And I see black people saying the same thing. Like, we've got people getting killed day by day. You know, we can't even, like, keep up with the hashtags at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being covered in the media extensively. Why are we still talking about clothes or hair? And the thing about the clothes and the hair and the gorilla pictures and the Harambe stuff is, like, it's all connected. It all relates to how black people are viewed in these societies, in American society, European, where you are, how, you know, Black Lives Matter did not just randomly come about. That was not, you know, kind of a whim that, you know, everybody's been on that kick. It's organic. It's we are insisting that our lives matter, that we are not the butts of your jokes. We are not target practice. We are not fodder for you. We are here. We are people. We're human. So I think, like, yeah, it's absolutely opportunist to think of themselves that way or not online, because I mean, who doesn't love a good joke? Who doesn't love a tweet that gets 1,000 retweets? I know I do.
Yeah, exactly.
More, and everybody wants to be a funny man, you know, so that makes sense, at least in my mind.
Yeah, exactly. And I was also talking to, like, a friend in the office here about the whole situation, and she was kind of talking about how it's really interesting how, like, so much of meme culture originates from black culture, but sort of, like, the people who get famous and notable for it are usually white. And, like, it almost feels like so many white meme makers get on Ellen and get money and stuff when, like, black culture sort of pioneered that shit. And it's kind of, like, with this whole Harambe thing, it's kind of this, like, weird, paradoxical, like, turnaround thing that's happened. And it's, like...
Yeah, I think Doreen St. Felix, a writer, I think she's based in Toronto, wrote a great piece about that for the Fader, about how you have these. And I referenced it in my good piece as well about, like, yeah, these are, I mean, it's literally like 13, 14, 16, 17-year-old black kids on the internet who make these things up for the most part. But I don't think it's that strange. I think that there's definitely a precedent for that. Ahmed Erdogan, the old Atlantic Records executive, said that, like, black music, black culture is imitated around the world extensively, to paraphrase. And I think that's still true. Like, you know who Jimmy Page is, but a lot of people don't know who Sister Rosetta Tharpe is.
Yeah.
Like a pioneer of, you know, 20th century blues and rock music as we know it. Like, it's an ongoing trend, and it is weird. You're right about, like, seeing these kids on Ellen, and they do some goofy thing, and they're getting, you know, a deal with a sneaker company or $10,000 or whatever it is. I think it's Harambe relates to that for sure, because I think the meme before this was That Boy, which I absolutely did not get. And I'm not sure. I'm a weirdo, and I've been on the internet forever, and I love weird crap. But, like, that was bizarre to me how that, like, exploded in popularity. It's a lot of that was centered around, like, mocking black culture, the way, you know, black people are perceived to talk, as though we all talk one way, and it's not proper. I don't know. It really is, like, echoes of a lot of stuff in the past, just kind of manifesting itself through technology and whatever else today.
The Wire.
Yes, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM, and we got an interesting text from a listener who says, in regards to the last story that we just played about whether the Harambe meme is racist or not, the text says, the issue with the meme isn't exclusively race-related. If it was a human that was shot dead, it would never be acceptable for that person's image to be splashed all over the internet for our entertainment. So why should it be any different for an animal? That's a really great point. Thanks, listener, for texting in.
Yeah, I think it's definitely like a double-edged sword, the race and also the fact that it's an animal, not a human. But, you know,
yeah. They're
so close to humans and us that it's like, yeah, such as they said before, such a beautiful creature that it's like... as disrespectful as if it was a person.
Yeah, and I think it's like an intersecting thing, right? You were kind of zooming in specifically on the race issue
Definitely.
Of it, but there's all sorts of other things
that's
going
like
on there as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's also like a really great point. I completely agree.
Cool. So for our final piece today, we're going to be playing the first report I ever did for BFM when I first started on the news team earlier in the year. I listened to it earlier and cringed a little bit, but I'm still really proud of it and I want to play it anyway. It looks at the cultural history of the term yas, which I feel like has kind of died out now, but was pretty ubiquitous on social media earlier this year. So, hope you enjoy.
If you're a user of the internet, then you may have noticed the recent rise of a certain phrase. The term yas has proliferated in New Zealand's social media spheres in recent months, often as a standalone caption to photos or videos, or as an enthusiastic comment of approval on friends' social media posts. But what does this phrase mean? And where did it come from to begin with? A quick initial Google search led me to Urban Dictionary, which told me that the term, used as a way to express excitement, became popular after a video of a Lady Gaga fan went viral in 2014.
Yes! Yes, Gaga, you look so good! Oh my God, yes! Gaga, you look beautiful!
News outlets, from BuzzFeed to Mary Claire, all attribute this Gaga fan, John Connolly, to the phrase, claiming that from this one Instagram video, an entire viral meme was born. Yas remixes of songs were created, the phrase appeared on t-shirts, and even a video of a cat saying Yas had its own share of virality.
Yas! You want one? Yas! You want one? Yas!
The widespread use of the phrase was also furthered through its frequent use in the popular TV show Broad City.
Yas! 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 BRB!
However, a deeper look tells me that it is not quite this simple. Sure, the viral nature of Connolly's video was integral to the spread of the phrase, but by no means was he the inventor of the term. The news website Mike tells me that Yas, in fact, might have its etymological roots in the black and Latino drag culture in New York during the 1980s. Jenny Livingston's 1990 documentary, Paris is Burning, captures the city's drag ball scene from this period. And in an opening scene, a black drag queen struts down the centre of a ballroom to cries of Yas from the crowd. Yas isn't the only phrase thought to have come out of this community. Throwing shade is another phrase you may have heard on the internet, which is also described in the Paris is Burning documentary by one of the film's main characters.
I don't tell you you're ugly, but I don't have to tell you because you know you're ugly. And that's shade.
If you're married...
So how do phrases travel from these communities to become part of the everyday internet speak in a place like New Zealand? I spoke with Associate Professor of Communication Studies at AUT, Dr. Lorna Piatti-Farnell, to get her thoughts.
It usually happens through forms of media, particularly entertainment media, which sort of start converging and blending, you know, from the subcultural, which we take it to be as part of a community of fans and community or lifestyle, which is not necessarily distributed via the main entertainment venues. But once that move happens, then we see the subcultural discourse becoming the mainstream discourse, which is, of course, is cyclical. Then it becomes stale, and then it goes back to the subcultural, but you don't see in popular culture. So I would say that popular media actually are at the center of this communication shift, which get picked up by a number of traditionally by institutions. So production companies, you know, that sort of like bring it out, you know, into the mainstream, in inverted commas. In our 21st century context, I actually think that social media are responsible for a lot of that convergence taking place, definitely.
But is it problematic that the original source of the phrase has gone uncredited by many in the media? I also asked Lorna about this.
That's a good question, in the sense that one way of answering it, and I know this would be the perception of not only scholars, but also lots of members of subcultural groups as well, would be to call it, to refer to it as cultural appropriation, sort of like expressions that denote a certain social and cultural identity that belong to a particular group, in this case, the African-American community, in the US particularly, then, you know, like it gets taken over by the mainstream and is looked at it in terms of appropriation, which sort of like makes it devoid of all those socio-historical and socio-economic, you know, like connections that go with it. So a line of thought, I guess, would look at it as cultural appropriation and would say, well, this is just yet another example of how popular culture feeds off subcultural discourses and completely devoids it of its socio-historical background. At the same time, as a cultural, you know, analyst myself, we must be aware of the fact that any part of cultural discourse is not static. Okay, so regardless of the source in itself, which is important to be aware of course, we also must be aware of the evolution of things like expressions, you know, in terms of the popular expressions, especially on social media. They kind of get a life of their own. And that life is just as important and in need of analysis as the origin of the term itself.
So I think in the end, it's tricky to simply determine whether it's right or wrong for New Zealand users of the internet to use phrases such as Yas. As Lorna says, cultural discourse is not static and language evolves in its own organic way. Nevertheless, I think trying to be conscious of the historical context and meaning of these terms is helpful. Not only does it help us avoid embarrassing blunders of using terms incorrectly in front of our friends, but it also helps in giving credit where it is due, and not erasing the rich histories of traditionally marginalised communities where these words may have originated.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that's the end of our last show for the year. Aww. So, yeah, I know. Yeah, thank you to everybody who spoke with us for the pieces that we played on the show today. So that was Shamabil Yacoub, Adam Winstock, Claire Curran, Jim Clark, Kasai Rex and Lorna Piatti-Farnell. Also, a huge thank you to Labour leader Andrew Little, who speaks with us every week on the Thursday show. And thank you to US reporter Jason Leopold for always giving us a great rundown of what's going on in the US, the state of the states, each week. Also, a very big thank you to my producer, Pearl. It's our last show together, because I'll be moving to the Wednesday show when we come back next year, and Pearl will be taking over as the Thursday host, which is a very bittersweet moment for me. Because I'm very sad and I've really enjoyed working with you, Pearl. Oh, but also, thanks. You're going to be a fucking great host next year.
Yeah, let's hope so. But no. No, it'll be fine. But thank you, Shemaine. I've learned a lot. And thank you to everyone who's listened to our shows and texted in and stuff. I love it.
Yeah,
and
everybody have a fucking great Christmas and New
Hell
Year. And
yeah.
We'll be back with you next year.
Woo!
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.